Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we're talking about the cult classic that still feels relevant 20 years after its release, Donnie Darko. We discuss how our interpretations of its cryptic story have changed over the years and debate the original cut versus the director's cut.
Donnie Darko.
That name, it sounds like a superhero.
I know. What kind of name is that?
You're weird. You're weird, Chris, to come up with a name like that.
Sly smile on my face.
Should we just act out the whole movie?
I would love to act out Sparkle Motion with you.
Where are you going?
I don't know my line.
Oh, and she goes, I'm going home.
I'm going home.
She looks at him bewildered, like, going home, dude. Like, where do you think I'm going? I'm a kid.
Yeah. What is this?
I just told you I have to study for this test.
It's funny how this movie at times feels just like a high school film.
Doesn't it feel like a high school film throughout the whole thing?
I mean, yeah.
It's a high school movie.
It's a high school movie. It's just, I think about it, I go back and forth because whenever I think about the movie, I think about the big highbrow concepts and the philosophical stuff that it's introducing. But then whenever I go back and rewatch it, it's like a teen rom-com superhero.
Yeah. I guess when I think about like the philosophical concepts, I think about the high school stuff. To me, this movie's kind of all about being a teenager and like kind of looking ahead and the world being scary and the future being scary, you know?
There's definitely an element of fear, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of there.
Fear and love. As I'm bopping around, how old was Richard Kelly when he made this?
I know, he was a kid. I mean, part of the reason I love this movie, and we'll get into it, but it's essentially made by a kid who wanted to write and direct. Nobody wanted him to direct it, and he kind of like forced his way through. And just like all the hoops he had to go through and all the ideas that he had and the fact that like this movie was born from like this young nobody who just had a crazy idea and like motivated someone as famous like Drew Barrymore to like push for the movie to be made. It was just, it's incredible that I feel like this kind of thing doesn't really happen anymore. Like there's a system set up for like young directors now, you know? But Richard Kelly is kind of DIY'd it.
Yeah, it's the background on it has always kind of fascinated me. That this movie exists at all has always
totally
kind of fascinated me.
And it almost didn't exist. Like it kind of bombed when it came out and nobody saw it and it found the second life.
Yeah, the box office was $7.5 million on a $4.5 million budget.
And is that the domestic box office? I believe when it originally came out, it kind of sunk in the water. It unfortunately came out right after 9/11, you know, with like the plane engine and everything. Like it just didn't have a great release and nobody wanted to buy it at Sundance. Everyone thought it was like too weird. And as far as I know, it kind of failed domestically, but then was loved in the UK, which doesn't surprise me at all that like the UK loves this depressing ass movie. and it just like kind of found a second life that way. At least that's how I understand the story.
I feel like there's probably something interesting too about like, I feel like cultures tend to be really fascinated by each other's high school experiences.
Yeah, you're right.
Because it's such a common touch point for everybody. Like we all kind of go to school, but the school in different cultures is so different. And I could just imagine like 2001, 2002, 2003, like people from the UK being like, is this what high school's like in America?
Yeah. All right. I got the BO numbers.
Yeah. It's depressing, isn't it?
Opening weekend, $110,000.
Which, not like a wide release. The peak was only 58 theaters. So, like,
but the theatrical run in total was 500,000.
Yeah, that's insane, isn't it? 500,000.
After reissues, it made the 7 million.
Yeah, which who knows when the reissues happened.
Well, after it kind of found a second life in the UK, people kind of started getting obsessed with it. And this was back when, like, I remember the Blair Witch Project did this. It was back then when there was this period where you could create a website, you know, one of those like old school shitty websites for a movie.
Angel Fire.
Yeah. And like you could go on the website and you could like, they had all these clues hidden. You could like find out more about the movie. And it kind of had like that. It was born from that kind of cult mentality of getting people obsessed about these little things and like not understanding the movie completely. And the lore built around it to the point where it did start getting these reissues. And another film studio came in and helped like release a DVD with the director's cut and everything. And like they wanted to push the movie as this like this oddity, and people latched onto it.
When do you remember hearing about it for the first time? Like, what's your history with Donnie Darko?
So I didn't really get into movies until my freshman year of high school. I think kind of heading in, or sorry, of college. I watched a lot of movies as a kid, but I wouldn't say like, it was just more that like my dad really liked movies and like they were always on. But I didn't get into like movies, you know, like the important movies, like The Godfather, you know, all that kind of stuff. Until my freshman year of college, and I think probably perusing around the IMDb top 250, I'm sure Donnie Darko is on there, and just hearing about like this weird movie where like, you know, it's like Jake Gyllenhaal, one of his first movies, and it's just this really strange time travel sci-fi kind of thing. And my guess is I watched it back then because I was watching anything I could get my hands on back then and not doing schoolwork and not going out, just watching movies. And I would imagine I watched it around then. I always had a fondness for it early on, but didn't really become a bigger fan until I met my wife, who I would have met in 2008, and she loved it. And because through her, I've just seen it so many times since then.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Loves this movie.
I remember being in high school. So I started high school in 2001. And that means the movie had just come out recently. And it was a friend of a friend.
Oh, wow.
Tommy, who I think was talking about it one day. And I don't know why. Maybe I had talked about Fight Club. I would talk about Fight Club a lot. And yeah, as somebody that suffered from insomnia in high school,
sure,
being like, oh, these movies that like you can't sleep. And somehow that got onto these like twisty, mind-bendy movies, and Donnie Darko came up. And the name, it's still such a... It's so catchy.
I mean, he is trying to make a superhero. Like it's supposed to have that energy.
Yeah. It works. And he gave me a burned copy of the movie.
Wow.
Tommy did.
You were there early.
Yeah. So I didn't have the DVD. I had a burned CD.
Mm-hmm. I remember those days.
Played on my PlayStation 2, I think.
Yeah.
And I ended up watching it that way. And I'm pretty sure I watched it, you know, one night when it was like 1 a.m. and just being completely
best way to do it.
Yeah. Blown away by what the hell I had just watched. Like, cause at that point I was just starting to understand movies on a deeper level. I think it was The Trio at this point, of seeing Fight Club, American Beauty, and Donnie Darko all kind of at once, and being like, oh, this is way different than the movies that I've been going to watch and see.
Yeah, those were the kinds of movies I was referring to, like the sort of movies you would watch. I was heading into college and realizing that all of these different kinds of movies existed.
Yeah, I was at that point just kind of seeing whatever the latest comedy was, latest action flick, just all the blockbusters.
Adam Sandler, every time Adam Sandler came out for a movie, I was there in the theater.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Still am, but you know, back then that's all I watched.
So there was definitely like an awakening when it came to this film, but Mad World blew my mind.
Oh yeah, of course.
When that scene first happened, I just remember being amazed.
This is like therapy. Like something was just triggered in me. Did you know the song Mad World before the movie? I don't mean the cover. I mean the original.
No, yeah, it was. I had never heard. I didn't even know this was a cover.
You didn't know that until just now?
Just now.
Oh, I'm going to blow your mind, Chris. Okay. You're going to love this. Oh, Chris, I know you so well. You're going to love this. Okay. First, the memory, though. I remember it must. So, yeah, I must have watched this movie my freshman year of college because there was this kid on my floor, and I won't say his name. And if God forbid he ever hears this, he'll probably know I'm talking about him. But you know, people change. I'm sure you're great now. And I know I was a little shit then too. So like, whatever, people go through things and change, but I'm going to tell the story about, he was just the most annoying person in the world. He was my friend's roommate. And like, God, I don't know why, like everything he said kind of irked me. And like, he would always kind of challenge me. Maybe he was kind of prodding me a little bit. Like I was a Chicago Bulls fan and he was a Cavaliers fan, and that was back when LeBron was, you know, just no matter how good the Bulls were, like LeBron would beat them in the playoffs and like you'd go home empty-handed. Although I would play him in whatever NBA game he had, and I always play as the Bulls, and he would get so pissed because all I would do is shoot threes, because like Kirk Heinrich and Ben Gordon, like even Luol Deng could hit a three once in a while. So like I would just like post guys up in the perimeter and like shoot threes the whole time, and all he would do is drive down the middle of the lane as LeBron and dunk. And we just went back and forth doing that until one of us started to pull away. Anyway, this is all very pertinent to the story. Just to create an atmosphere of how much I did not like this person. And
this is your tangent universe.
Yes, exactly. And I remember specifically once I was lying in my bed, and I love the Gary Jules version of Mad World, but the original version, which was done by Tears for Fears, which is a band I absolutely love, I have always loved. People made fun of me for liking Tears for Fears, but I still like them, which I guess that was a kind of a preview of my life going forward. And I just remember saying, like, sitting in my bed listening to Mad World by Tears for Fears, and this kid comes in and he's like, what's this? Because he knows the Gary Jules version, because we've all seen Donnie Darko and we all like Donnie Darko. I was like, it's Tears for Fears, man. Like, this is, and I was like, this is the better version. And he was like, this sucks. You know, he just like telling me the song sucks. I was like, fuck you. Just sitting there seething. So yeah, I just have a specific memory of that. So I must have seen Donnie Darko then, but that is really beautiful, right? That, you know, the song that appears at the end of the movie, it's a sort of respite at the end of the movie after Donnie has sacrificed himself and all these people are crying and the song's playing. It's a cover of a Tears for Fears song. And there's a Tears for Fears song famously in this movie. I don't know why I'm blanking on the name of it. The song that appears at the Head Over Heels. So like there's this update of an 80s song at the end of the movie, but it's like, it's a cover. It's this modern version suddenly. And it feels like this, it feels like we're stepping into like a new world kind of, because we actually are. It feels like it's kind of looking forward and into something new. And it just feels so appropriate and poetic that we're getting this cover of an 80s song that is just really stripped down acoustic version, you know?
I do, you're right. I do love this because The fact that the whole film is the tangential universe, which is a, you know, a side creation to the primary universe based on a glitch that occurs. It's kind of a copy.
Yeah.
Having a cover of a song at the end of the movie is very fitting in that way, that the cover is kind of a copy.
Yeah. And the coolest part of that is that wasn't really planned. They didn't have a song for the end of the movie. There was just supposed to be score, but the guy they hired to do the score, like, just came up with this idea and had his friends sing the song. They sent it in. They were like, holy shit. Like, it's just an amazing, like, what an incredible thing that this guy did this without even knowing that Head Over Heels is, he probably is. Well, maybe he does know. Maybe he found it poetic now that I'm thinking about it. But still, like, to have that idea and to put that, and now it's like kind of, it's one of those songs where, like, you could never hear the song without thinking of the end of the movie. And you could never, like, no other song could ever work at the end of the movie like this one could. It's incredible.
It has that same energy as Fight Club and Where's My Mind.
Yeah, right.
Where it just kind of defines the movie. And in turn, the movie comes to define the song.
Right. Yeah, totally. Or Wise Up and Magnolia, if I can reference a 1999 Travis movie.
Of course you can. Of course you can.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So we watched the director's cuts, mm-hmm. but then also the theatrical cuts.
I feel like I forced you to watch the theatrical cuts.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, because I go back and forth on which one I like better, because I had just watched the theatrical cut until I wrote about the movie a few years ago. And when I wrote about the movie, I watched the director's cut for the first time and was kind of blown away by the extra layers of nuance that it added. I mean, and it's not even all nuance. Some of it is just like outright blatant.
I would say it's more blatant than nuance.
Yeah, but there is like a little bit more. There's more. Like, the whole conversation about the rabbits, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I like
to
that
the film. But this time watching the director's cut. So when I wrote about it, I watched it. I kept rewatching it because there were all these little things to figure out. And this was one of those movies that, like, I never really felt certain about and felt like I could explain well. And having watched the director's cut, I was like, oh, it's because half the information that you need just isn't in the movie. There's implications of it, but I don't think there's any way to really pin down that there's a tangent universe. You kind of get the impression of it when everybody's like waking up and you see them being like, oh, I experienced this thing, or sobbing or seeing a little freaked out. It raises the question. You're maybe like, oh, maybe that was a dream or something. But a full-on tangent universe is you'd be having to make like a huge reaching pitch for that.
Yeah.
So the director's cut, I really appreciated for the fact that it answered so many of the questions that I had lived with for nearly 20 years of my life.
Right, yeah.
But rewatching it this time, it felt a lot more indulgent and a lot slower, and I understood why people didn't like it as much. Mm-hmm. Especially then watching the director's cut and being like, oh, this, or the theatrical cut, and being like, oh, this flows so smoothly.
Yeah. Yes. That's my big thing. Like, I agree. Like, I think I went from a sort of abject despisal of the director's cut just because of what it represented. And it, in a lot of senses, it represents like the opposite of what I want from movies. Like the fact that we need to see pages from the book to understand the movie. Like, I just get so mad even thinking about that, that anyone would think that's necessary. Like, I don't know if you remember this, Curtis. We were texting about this movie once, me, you, and Jordan. And I said something along the lines of, I don't know, I prefer the ambiguity of time travel in the original. And I remember you getting kind of annoyed, maybe a little bit. And saying, like, I don't know about annoyed, but just like in a very crisp response, like, you can't understand the movie unless you understand like the nuances of the time travel. And I guess I understand that in a way. And this time watching the director's cut, I was a lot more sympathetic towards it and even liked a lot of the scenes. I think some of the scenes are really great and could have been in the movie. You've already noted the Watership Down scene, or what is the name of that? Yeah, Watership Down. And the scene with his dad, where his dad's like drinking whiskey outside, you know? And he says, like, they're all bullshitters. Like, that was such a great moment because the movie's all about these disparate forces, like, trying to control Donnie and make him conform and think a certain way. And in that very, like, Joseph Campbell way, like, everybody's kind of a mentor, you know? Everybody is, like, a lesson about a certain way you could be or live. And, you know, you've got politics and you've got, like, self-help and you've got this very Republican, like, conformity sort of thing. And then you have his dad who is just, like, who represents this, no, you don't need any of that. Just, like, be yourself. You're not crazy. It was, like, a really beautiful element to add to all that, and it like helped. It was nice to for Donnie to have a moment with his dad too, in that moment with his mom where he says his brain isn't broken. Like, that was so good. But beyond that, a lot of the scenes are just like extra. We talk a lot about math in the show, Chris, and like this, when I was thinking about this, it was making me think of our math discussions where, like, you know, in a math equation, more is more. 1 + 1 = 2, and 2 is more than 1. But in this movie, like, that's my thing about movies. Like, more isn't necessarily more. Like, having all that information, it's funny because you're right. Having all the information of the director's cut, like, does pin things down and make things exact, which I like having. So that's why, like, I liked watching the director's cut this time, because I'm a fan of the movie, and, like, I have this thing now that I can reference, and it's this weird, it's like a tangent universe of the old movie. Like, it's kind of cool to have, you know? But it's not, in my mind, like, it doesn't help me understand the movie more necessarily. Like, just because it's pinned down these things and made things exact, you know, when I was learning about stuff like the tangent universe, or even at the end when people are crying, it's not like that information that I learned about why that's happening, it wasn't necessarily new to me. Like, the information's new, but, like, the way it made me feel wasn't new. Like, I kind of understood it all emotionally. And that's all that really mattered to me in the first place. So adding more to this movie, and like you said, like, kind of slowing things down and making things less efficient, it kind of ruins the groove and flow of the movie in a way that actually in turn makes all of that information it's telling me a little less powerful because it makes the movie not work as well, you know?
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's 20 minutes.
That's a lot.
20 minutes is a lot. Yeah, it's the theatrical, the credits start at like an hour 47.
Uh-huh.
And in the director's cut, it's 2:07.
Yeah, about that.
So, yeah, 20 minutes is a huge amount of extra stuff. And as you said, there's, like, the scene with his dad can be pretty nice. Mm. It gives some of the actors a bit more to do, and you get to see a bit more of them. It reminds me of In Vanilla Sky, What's his face? Who directed Vanilla Sky?
Cameron Crowe.
Cameron Crowe said that he wishes he could have spent more time or given Kurt Russell more to do.
Yeah.
Having rewatched the movie, like, he would have included more Kurt Russell. And I could see the appeal of that, especially with the dad in this movie being so interesting.
Yeah.
Who is the dad in this?
Let's see. Darko.
Eddie Darko. Oh, Holmes Osborne.
What a name.
Yeah.
Wow. He's in Southland Tales. I love that. I love that Richard Kelly just like keeps working with the same people.
I still haven't seen Southland Tales.
Oh, interesting. We should cover it. Because it does kind of a Richard Kelly by nature, I think, because of Donnie Darko, has a bit of a following. And I actually saw Southland Tales back when there was a director's cut of it that came out, and they were showing it in a small theater in Minneapolis. And I went to it, and Richard Kelly actually opened and talked to the crowd and shit. It was cool.
Whoa.
That's a movie I've never loved. Like, I love Richard Kelly, and I think like he has cool and interesting ideas, but to me it was a movie that didn't work. But I'm kind of interested to revisit it, and I wonder if like I should just revisit it, write about it, and we should talk about it in this show, and just like, so I can work out all my feelings about this movie.
I would be down for that. Yeah. It seems like something that would either really work for me or really fail for me.
It's a really weird movie. Even like compared to Donnie Darko, it's pretty weird.
I found the text messages, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
It says, you said, it's not even remotely interesting to me. It's the opposite of interesting.
Okay, yeah, again, abject despisal.
I said, how dare you? You said, I know I'm bad. I prefer the ambiguity of time travel. And I said, the time travel becomes part of a larger statement on simulation theory. As if that's a great point. Oh, my God. Rather than just a random ambiguous thing. LOL, a very crisp response.
Which I was just thinking, so.
Yeah, I was thinking it. And then Jordan said, I found it boring and obnoxious to the extreme.
Yeah.
But I think he's talking about something else.
Oh, yeah. I remember that conversation, though, because we didn't really get into it, but over the years, I've seen Donnie Darko so many times. Again, because my wife loves it. And it's this movie I love revisiting. Like, I really fall into the energy of this movie. And I feel like I really know the people. And I love being part of this cryptic universe. Like, it's just so cool. I think a powerful part of the movie, and again, why I don't necessarily love the director's cut, is I think part of the not knowing is the power of the movie, that there aren't answers, because there aren't answers in life. And I just like that element of it. Where was I going? Oh, but I remember that this particular conversation we were all having together, it was because I had bought Donnie Darko on 4K from Arrow, who does pretty much the best 4K releases. And they had a bunch of like cool supplemental material, which I actually watched and read for this podcast. I mean, why else do I buy this shit? Like, I got to read it and watch it all eventually. It was kind of nice to be able to do that. But I just remember watching the director's cut, and it was the first time, and I didn't watch the original cut. I only had watched the director's cut on 4K. And I remember thinking like, oh, this movie like doesn't work like I thought it did. My immediate thought was like, this movie didn't age well. Like, despite me loving it, it hasn't aged well. And it wasn't until this watch for this podcast that I realized that, no, it was just because I watched the director's cut. Like, the original cut, it's still one of my favorite movies, honestly. Like, it feels incredible. It doesn't feel like any other movie.
No, it's so unique in terms of, I mean, it's such a blend of approachable, but having these artistic shots and moments, you can tell that the actors had really bought in to the scenes and the performances. Like, having both Gyllenhaals, Jake and Maggie, is just like an awesome dynamic. I've always been super impressed with this movie. One thing that did jump out to me between these two, the opening song is different.
Is it really?
When he's riding his bike.
It is. Yeah. I was sitting there like watching it. There were just moments where like, even though I've seen the original cut so many times, I'm like, is this different than, like, I could never pick them out, you know?
Yeah, I was jumping back and forth between them sometimes for the differences. And it's like the opening scene in the theatrical, I don't know what the song is. I probably should have looked it up. But the last line you hear right when he's getting home is something about fate and being up against your will. So there's a little bit of a nod there. But then in the director's cut, it's a song about two worlds colliding. I thought was just one of the changes that makes it super on the nose.
That I'm looking at it now. You're right. It is just a different song. I was like, Asan always plays at the beginning, but it's just a different song. And this is another reason why the director's cut is not as good, is the original cut had Echo and the Bunnymen, and Echo and the Bunnymen's one of the best 80s bands ever. So
this is the first time I've ever heard of them.
Echo and the Bunnymen. I mean, you would know their songs if you heard them.
Would I?
Well, I mean, do you know the song from the movie? I mean, that's a song I instantly recognize.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I was watching a bunch of movies my freshman year of college, I was also listening to a lot of like 80s music, a lot of like new wave stuff. So I guess it's funny in thinking about that, all the merging of like liking movies like Donnie Darko and liking music that was in Donnie Darko. That's interesting.
Yeah. What impact did this movie have in your life?
Crazy.
So what jumped out to you on this watch, if anything?
I think just, again, I've seen it so many times, but sitting down and watching it for a podcast and thinking about it critically, there was a different energy of me watching it. Like maybe I was just a little more aware and attuned to things, but there was one specific moment that I think kind of kickstarted how incredible I thought the movie was. First of all, the opening shot's incredible. Where he's that steady cam going down the road and finding Donnie Darko in the middle, and then that shot of like the specific rim behind him. Did I say specific? Pacific Rim. Yeah. It's my lisp coming out. It's just so beautiful. But then following that, when he goes home and then like the day happens and he wakes up the next night, it's incredible that the movie suddenly has a very different tone and feel after that. And knowing what I know about the movie now, that it is this tangent universe and you actually are entering a different world, the fact that the movie kind of was conscious of that and made an artistic decision to make the scene feel different than what we had seen so far. Because up to that point, it felt like an 80s movie, you know? It felt like an MTV music video, which was cool and is a very interesting and important part of the movie and the whole aesthetic. But the scene where Donnie Darko walks outside, it's really interesting because he's walking forward and he walks into the center of the frame. Like there's suddenly this very formal composition, which before that there wasn't. You know, it's steady cam moving around, it's the music video, the dinner scene where it's just like cutting back and forth. All of a sudden there's this very different feel with Donnie Darko walking straight into the camera down the center, and he's kind of out of focus, and the focus slowly comes in and you see Donnie and he's looking forward, and then it fades into Frank the Bunny, who's standing across from him in the golf course, who's also in the center of the frame. And it's just such like a cool, interesting decision that it's something that, again, is not stated. Like, we don't know that this is the introduction of a tangent universe, yet it's filmed that way. And we have the sense that something is different. Like, that's the power of art to me, when it can convey things visually and powerfully like that. So I think from that point forward, I was very conscious of like how the movie flowed in and out of that aesthetic. And when we were kind of in the real world where like you're just a teenager trying to get by and figure things out, and when shit gets crazy, you know, when you're looking at a bunny in your bathroom and trying to stab him, like it's really cool how the movie moves in and out of that so seamlessly. I was just so overwhelmed and impressed by just how well that was done. I think that's what stood out to me the most.
I got some flack on Twitter because somebody was saying Barbie was just like a movie about a toy.
Yep.
And I mentioned something that it was making some like unique and daring choices, and all these people are like, what's daring about blah blah blah? It has a truck ad in the middle of it. And I'm sitting there thinking about like the formal stuff you're talking about, right? In terms of like unique and daring in terms of it's mixing up shot selections. It's mixing up like some of the tone of scenes. It's just doing these very small things that you don't get from a lot of movies, especially when you watch movies in bulk the way that like you and I do, but like so many people do.
Yeah.
It's like the more you watch, the more you can become a little desensitized to the way in which things become a bit more generic or rote. And that's the thing with Donnie Darko that always kind of jumps out to me is how fresh it still kind of feels.
Totally.
It has some of the American Beauty Magnolia energy to me. There's like kind of a something about the shots and editing.
I would say Mulholland Drive too. I was kind of thinking about the clear influence Lynch had on this movie.
There's just something from that like 1998 to 2002 period where there's just like a handful of films that have that kind of tone and style about them that I adore.
Yeah. Love it.
What did that make me?
Were you trying to think of the thing you liked the most?
Yeah. On this rewatch, like the thing that kind of jumped out to me, I guess is still the rabbit conversation.
I think the director's cut.
Yeah, that's to me the biggest loss in the theatrical is that I think you could cut out all the expositional stuff. And if you just kept the Deus Ex Machina bunny scene.
Yeah, right.
It conveys so much because it does set up the idea of like the god in the machine that you don't otherwise get, which does solve some of the issues that you're having with the movie with just some of the the visuals that we get throughout it. And you also then get the more existential conversation where Gretchen talks about how we care about these characters because the storyteller cared about the characters. And that's such a fascinating point to me, is that the people we see in the Tangent universe may not be who the people are in the primary universe. So Gretchen's whole demeanor, backstory, everything, who she is in the primary universe could be completely different because everybody in the Tangent universe is there to drive Donnie to destroy the Tangent universe.
Right.
So there's something very fascinating to me about spending all this time with these characters and getting to know them, only to have the rug pulled out from under you and say, you don't actually know any of these people.
Right.
And who they really are could be completely different from who you saw in that Tangent universe. Who did Beth Grant play? Kitty? Like, Kitty could be completely normal. She might not be an obsessive, annoying, frustrating person. Maybe Seth Rogen's like a nice guy. That always kind of fascinated me, is that are we supposed to be happy that some of these characters lived, or are we supposed to be angry that some of these characters aren't facing consequences when we don't actually know who they are in the real world? And it's like, are we relieved that Gretchen's alive at the end of the movie? But is that even the Gretchen that we knew? Should we still be mourning the Gretchen that we had spent time with? The Gretchen from the Tangent universe. So Donnie takes that very harsh point of like, these people don't matter. They're just rabbits and we shouldn't care about them at all.
Yeah.
While Gretchen takes this very like compassionate, vicarious tone that I think a lot of people that love stories feel when it comes to attachment to characters. While Drew Barrymore takes a much more like Deus Ex Machina, philosophical.
Yeah.
We don't really care about the characters, but we need to look at the point that the characters are serving. I think that's such a rich vein of adding depth and layers and nuance to the movie that doesn't take up a lot of time. It's an intriguing scene in and of itself and recontextualizes so much of the movie in a way that I think is helpful, that my ultimate cut is just the director's cut with that scene thrown in.
I can't wait for that cut someday.
I know.
They should let you do it.
Arrow, if you're listening. No, not Arrow. Richard.
Yeah, or Newmarket. As you were talking about that, it made me remember that in that scene towards the end where they're at Grandma Def's house and the bully kid. Oh, I'm not going to remember his name. I know he's the lead singer of Phantom Planet, but that's all I can remember.
I had no idea.
Who is this guy? Anyway, the lead singer of Phantom Planet, whoever this... I don't even remember the bully character's name. Oh, Alex Greenwald. That's right. He plays Seth. Alex Greenwald, who's the lead singer of Phantom Planet, that's the band that Jason Schwartzman is the drummer in. And Jason Schwartzman is basically the reason this movie got made, actually, because he originally wanted to kick Gyllenhaal's part. And the fact that, like, this hot young kid, you know, this the hot new thing in Hollywood who was in Rushmore wants to be in Donnie Darko. Like, that's how the script started gaining a lot of traction in the first place. Huh. So it's just like a weird turn of events that Alex Greenwald ended up being in this movie. Anyway, that scene where he's pinning Donnie down and he's going to cut him. And Donnie says, he says something about Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, he does say Deus Ex Machina.
Which apparently, and I remember seeing that in the director's cut and saying like, oh, is that what he says? Like, is this new? Because like this scene feels the same to me. And I'm reading here that in the director's cut, they just make it more clear that he says it. Because apparently it was like muffled before.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So I agree. That's very important.
It's strange because even if it's just him saying Deus Ex Machina in the director's cut or the theatrical cut, I don't know. I guess that introduces, but that's something to where putting on my like writer hats or editor hat, it's just like you need a little more than just like one muttered statements.
I would agree.
Of Deus Ex Machina.
Like, my big gripe about the director's cut is it just makes things, like, more efficient and not flow as well. But I think keeping that whole Watership Down scene, like, it wouldn't kill the flow of the movie at all. Like, the scene works. That's the other thing a lot about a lot of the director's cut scenes is, like, they just feel a little plotting sometimes. And the pace isn't great. And it's clear, like, it wasn't fully worked out. And there's a reason they cut it in the first place. I know that for the director's cut... when they put out the DVD, you know, when the movie was gaining traction, the studio just came to them and said, like, hey, like, let's put in a director's cut. It's not like Richard Kelly wanted a director's cut. Like, they made all the cuts they made in the first place for a reason. So, like, they were, like, forced to add 20 minutes to the movie, kind of. So it's not surprising to me that a lot of the scenes in the director's cut just don't really work and are just thrown in. Like, they kind of are fan service in that way. Like, it's here's more to look at, you know. But this scene would have been good. I agree.
Yeah, it seems like the one thing... I mean, the dad scene I like, but does it feel quite as necessary?
No, it's not completely necessary.
But what was the reaction? I wonder what the reaction to Gyllenhaal's performance was. Because I feel like this had to have been like an immediate... Was he already gaining traction at this point?
I mean, I know his first movie was October Sky, and that would have... been only a couple years earlier. So I would imagine, yeah, this is a big role for him, especially since a lot of young actors were vying for this role, including Jason Schwartzman, who was, you know, the second Rushmore came out, he was huge.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
I remember seeing Rushmore on the Hollywood Video shelves.
Yeah.
But I can't remember when I actually watched it or what I thought of it.
I haven't seen it in years. It's one I've always like wanted to rewatch.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at Jake Gyllenhaal's list of movies. He was in City Slickers.
Oh, that's right. He's like he's just like a little kid in the opening.
Yeah. So October Sky, 1999.
Yeah, 99.
Homer Hickam. So yeah, Donnie Darko really was. It was Donnie Darko and Bubble Boy in the same year.
Oh man, Bubble Boy.
Yeah, I remember the trailer for Bubble Boy and just being like, "What the hell is this?"
I saw that so many times in Comedy Central.
Really?
Yeah, I watched it a lot.
I've avoided ever seeing it.
It's actually kind of impressive in just how bold it is. Like, what an insane concept.
Is there anything that's still like you're not sure of in Donnie Darko or anything that still is kind of like a tension point?
I mean, you asked that and like as far as like the logic goes, like I don't care. So like anything I'm not sure of, like it doesn't bother me. Is there anything that I just don't, I don't know. I think the movie's pretty perfect. Like even all the way down to the soundtrack, like I just love a movie with a good soundtrack, and every song in this movie, you know, Tears for Fears, Echo and the Bunnymen, Joy Division, like all these awesome bands in the soundtrack. It's one thing I really, really love about this movie, and thinking about that head over heels scene where we're kind of the montage where we're going through the high school, and that scene is still just like, I know it goes without saying, but that scene is incredibly done. It flows so well. It was like perfectly envisioned and carried out exactly how Richard Kelly wanted it. And everything it's doing like serves the movie so well too. Like it's introducing all of these people that will represent these forces that are vying for Donnie Darko. Like, you know, or just people that represent the tension of high school. Like you've got the bullies, you've got the girl who is going to be part of like this weird element of the movie where like Donnie and his friends are just horny, you know, like they're talking about Smurfs. And like it's this really funny like addition to the Donnie Darko universe that is normal to a high school movie but is done in a really fun and interesting way. And then you've even got like who's the crazy teacher, not Kitty, is that her name?
Yeah, Kitty.
Oh yeah, Kitty. Who was like fascinated by Jim Cunningham, and you see her introducing Jim to the principal, and like that's the introduction of his character, and like her trying to bring him in, and then right at the same time, like Drew Barrymore and her friend walk up, and like they're the liberal teachers that represent like this opposite mentality, and are trying to drive kids in another direction. Like it's just so cool how the opening scene kind of navigates through all of that while feeling like an MTV music video, feeling like an 80s movie. It's just such an incredible energy that's part of this movie and so essential to the coming of ageness of it. Because the movie really is about a teenager, like about this kid who's just like, he's so afraid of being alone, finally having all those questions that we all have around that age of like, is there a God? Like, it's why he latches on the predestination, because like it's somebody guiding him and like he doesn't feel alone. It's just, and all of these entities that exist around him beyond the philosophical, like in the real world, that are trying to like pull him in different directions. It all just works and coalesces so well, like immediately because of that head over heels scene. Like, it's just so cool that that's all set up and carries out perfectly throughout after that. You asked me to say if there's anything I don't like in the movie, and all I'm doing is sitting here telling you like what I love about it. I guess I think this movie's perfect. Like everything after that is just perfect.
Not necessarily what you didn't like, but if there was still something that was kind of like up in the air for you.
If there is, I'm having trouble thinking of it.
What you were saying though, I think one of the fascinating things, like when we stop looking at just like what's the logic of the movie, but really like what is the movie about? And there is something that it seems like if Donnie's going back to the primary universe to get crushed, right? Because at the end, that's essentially what happens, is he appears in the bed, and we don't know if that's him waking up from his dream and he understands what's about to happen and is just laughing, or if it's Donnie from the Tangent universe just kind of amazed by what happened and choosing to get crushed,
right?
Or if he's just kind of like a maniac
totally
at that point, and like laughing in his bed and gets crushed. But there's something to me about this idea of this understanding of how limited time is, especially something that you feel as like a teenager, that you might not, there's that sense of like immortality, but also a sense of maybe none of these things will ever happen for me.
Right.
And it's like, if Donnie was going to get crushed by this thing, he got to have this tangent universe where he got to fall in love, like loses virginity, connect with people, like have this moment with his dad, have this moment with his mom, see his sister doing well. It's there's something almost idealistic about it, of tying up loose ends, to where when he comes back to that moment right before the jet engine falls on him, instead of it being this tragic, I mean, it's still tragic no matter what, but instead of it being cutting short all the potential, it's like he got to live this other life and experience all of these things. So he wasn't quite as alone or empty at the moment of death as he would have been if the Tangent Universe had it happened.
Yeah.
There's something fascinating to me about that, about this idea of catharsis, or this idea of not being lonely because of these things that you got to experience, and what that says about facing death and coming to terms with death.
Wow. You're making my hair stand on its stand on it. That's such a, like, I've always felt that way about the ending, but the way you just phrased it and the way it kind of reorients how you look at the whole movie, I mean, yeah, that's really beautiful. And it's such an important part of the movie too, in Donnie's discovery, that weirdly enough, it kind of makes me think of Source Code, which a movie he's in that I just watched. And this idea that your legacy goes beyond like your mortal body, like it's all about the people you affect and the change you create. There's some element of that, I feel like, at the end of Donnie Darko, and mixed up in what you've just said, and that he envisioned this whole universe. He sees how things are. He sees the impact he could have had. And the comfort you have in dying and knowing that, A, there's more, like there's more beyond this universe that you don't understand. Like the fact that he went through this whole time travel scenario, like screams, like there's more out there. Like there's entities and forces beyond your control and bigger than you that you're going to learn all about in whatever the next step is. But also just that, you know, after he dies and like there's that ending montage going through everybody, Jane Cunningham, he's a terrible person and he should be punished, but we see him crying in his bed. Like there's, he feels like somebody who's tortured. Like he's overwhelmed in that motion, in that moment emotionally, because he must be a fucked up person to be doing the things he's doing. Like in this new universe, you just kind of see that, like, while Donnie's not there, like we got a glimpse of like the way things could be, or the way people truly are. And this new universe that's going to exist, like Donnie kind of had an impact on it in a way, like just because of through what we saw and like the way what happened to people and who they became and this kind of new fresh slate they have. I don't know. There's something about all that that's just so, I mean, I'm sitting here like there's no answer. I can't explain it, which is again why I love this movie. Like it's just interesting, like to have this new universe and to have all of these crazy new narratives play out that we'll know nothing about, and we don't know how Donnie affected them. Yet at the same time, it feels like Donnie has completely affected them. Like it really announces the power of the individual.
Yeah, and the way in which you can affect the world around you without people. That's what I always loved about the final wave between Gretchen and Donnie's mom.
Yeah.
Is that they don't know each other in this world. They've never met. I don't even know if they knew each other in the previous one.
Yeah, right.
But there's something, because of having that echo of the Tangent Universe, I talk about it in the article, but this movie kind of has some Inception vibes to it.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, in Inception, the whole thing is that you plant this idea and that can infect people beyond the time that they wake up and have a lasting impact. And it's like we see that in that wave, that they can't point to why they feel a connection. And the fact that it's the mother of Donnie with the love interest of Donnie, there's some kind of shared connection via Donnie there that causes them to span the grief, the curiosity, all the emotion, and just have this moment of interaction that is simple. It's just a gesture, but it conveys so much. I think that's really cool in terms of getting at the lasting impact or the legacy somebody can have on the world, that even if you don't know of the impact, like, we're all here because of things people did thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago.
Right.
And we're just the chain of all of these events that have happened, which is kind of wild to think about. You don't know the number of people that have made an impact on your life through things that they did and loss and not being here. Yeah. It's kind of, it's a wild thing to kind of be hinting at the end, or try to encapsulate at the end of this movie. And I don't think it's something that a lot of movies attempt to touch upon.
Mm.
So the fact that this one does, I think, is one of the reasons why it has such a profound, even if you can't explain it, a profound impact on so many people, or
yeah,
leaves people feeling something that they might not be able to explain.
You know, all of this is making me think of one thing in this movie I had never really noticed. I mean, obviously I'd noticed it. I know this scene, but I had never really thought about it. And maybe you wrote about this in your article. By the way, Chris wrote about this movie for Film Colossus. Have you updated that article before?
No, haven't updated it.
Okay.
But I need to write like a whole thing.
Update it by completely redoing it.
Yeah.
But did you talk about the Frankie Fiedler scene?
Who's Frankie Fiedler?
Okay, so I thought maybe by saying that you would just know instantly, but I'm being a little cryptic.
The boyfriend that's the artist?
No. So there's the scene after the jet engine falls in the house and Donnie and his family are staying at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
And the dad is lying in bed with the mom, and he can't help but think of this kid, Frankie Fiedler, who died, who went to their school.
Yeah.
And I feel like the implication here is that, like, this kid, Frankie Fiedler, died and was, like, the old Donnie Darko, like a Donnie Darko that existed 30 years ago or whatever, that had to go through the same thing Donnie went through and save the universe. And then he's reincarnated as Frank in the Tangent universe. Like, he comes back to warn, like, the new kid who has to save. And, you know, in 30 years from now, Donnie will come back as... maybe he'll be a frightening chicken or something. Who knows? But he's going to, like, tell some kid to save the world. And it makes me think of everything we're talking about, that, like, things are cyclical, that, like, people are connected, that we're affected by people in the ways we don't know. And it's just so interesting that there could be, like, there's always going to be this savior figure in this town who has to come forward and save the world, you know?
Yeah, I noted that conversation this time, now that you...
yeah.
Said it, but I haven't looked into it yet in terms of, like, piecing it together. That's a good call. That does feel like something that's put in there as a bit of a signpost.
Yeah. And it's the scene in the director's cut, it's a little extended. Like, he talks about, like, he thinks somebody was watching over Donnie, so it kind of plays into that whole idea a little bit more.
Yeah, I have down in my notes the quote of somebody was watching over him.
Yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah, somebody was watching over him. There's also something, like, he asked Frank how Frank got his name, and he said it was my father's name and my father before his.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if we're supposed to think that, like, the Frank that runs over Gretchen is somehow related, because the dad says that kid died in high school, right?
Yeah.
So... you wouldn't imagine that he had a kid. I mean, it's still possible, but like, if Donnie and Gretchen slept together, it's possible that Donnie had a kid in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's a Tangent universe.
Yeah.
No, it's not. Sorry.
Well, yeah, but who knows? We don't know how pregnancies in the Tangent universe work. Like, maybe he is the spiritual father of whatever kid Gretchen goes up to have.
Yeah, there's a whole thing you could dive into. I also forgot about Gretchen getting run over completely.
Yeah.
As I said that. But there is something interesting to that. And just all the religious stuff that kind of comes in, the political stuff that comes in. There's a lot of areas that this movie's touching on, which you mentioned earlier, that it's bold, it's ambitious, it's saying something. It's hard. Like, I find it hard not to admire this movie.
Yeah. I was blown away by it. I mean, I've seen it several times, and I felt more blown away by it in this last watch than I'd ever had before.
Nice. Well, then, rankings, Travis.
Well, one last thing I want to say, and I guess this goes without saying again, but everybody in this movie does such a good job. Even like the bullies, like Seth.
Yeah.
Seeing Seth. Why am I blanking on his name?
Rogan.
I wanted to say Seth Green. I almost said it like five times. Seth Green and Alex Greenwald as the bullies are so great. Beth Grant as Kitty is awesome. Patrick Swayze is like, he's the best. The mom and dad are awesome. But who was I going to know? Oh, Jenna Malone. I have grown to absolutely adore Jenna Malone. I really like her in Nicholas Winding Refn's movies. She's like in The Neon Demon and she's in his Amazon show. But I just think she's awesome. And now every time I see her in this movie, I'm just like, wow, she had it like early. Like she knew what she was doing. And there's this moment in the movie that I learned about from listening to the watching. There's like a making of documentary on the Arrow Blu-ray. And there's this moment where you first see her at her locker. She's looking in the mirror, and the DP, who is great DP, Stephen Poster, who worked with Richard Kelly after this movie on all of his movies. I accidentally made two more movies, but still. He couldn't get like a shot of Jenna Malone's face properly. Like you see her in the mirror, but when she turns, he couldn't get her face because it was engulfed in shadow. And he said like, hey, just like look up at the ceiling light when you turn around from your locker. And it's like a strange cue to give somebody. Like that's not a natural thing to do. Like why would you turn around and like look up? But she does. And it looks so natural. Like she didn't even question. She's like, oh yeah, I can do that. And she does it so effortlessly that now every time I watch this movie, I'm going to note that moment and just think like, wow, like that's how good she is that she can do something like so strange like that and make it look so wonderful. And you see her face like lit up and it's just, it's such a cool moment.
Yeah, it's always fun diving into things like that when you start to become so close to a movie that you start knowing those little details and it just continues to add to the affection that you have for it.
Yeah, totally.
It is probably worth mentioning too, there's the sequel S Darko.
Yeah, I've never seen that one.
I haven't either. Kelly had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
It says in the Wikipedia article that he said he resents being asked about the sequel and that he had never seen it. Which is pretty funny. And then he did say in 2017 that he had new ideas for a sequel.
Wow.
And in 2021, January of 2021, he announced that an enormous amount of work had been done on the script. So I guess he had some time during COVID to do some work. But I don't think there's been an update since then.
I had a feeling we were going to get something from him because what the box, when did the box come out? That was his last movie.
I have no idea.
The box came out in 2009.
Ooh.
And he kind of got like, you know, that like Hollywood canceled thing that happens to people where like his movies were just like too weird and not following the rules that like movies are supposed to be following. Like he got away with it in Donnie Darko, but like South End Tales was a failure and the box was weird. So like he just wasn't allowed to make movies after that. He was like in movie jail. But in the last few years with, you know, Donnie Darko, of course, like has always had a following, and then Southland Tales kind of had a resurgence with it getting the director's cut and getting a re-release from Arrow and all that. I just had this feeling that like, oh, Richard Kelly's really going to ride this momentum and like do something weird soon. And it's awesome to hear that he's thinking of a sequel.
Well, so he did an interview with the film stage in July of 2023. So just like very recently, and it's, I guess, a very rare thing for him to give an interview.
Oh, wow.
And apparently they said they weren't allowed to ask him about anything that he's been working on. That was like one condition of the interview. So there's nothing about anything that he's been working on. He did just say that he's been working with like major studios on things and has been like rigorously dedicated to this kind of stuff, and that he has some exciting things. It's just, it all takes such a long time and it's very frustrating how long it takes.
he's well aware of that, I'm sure, just from his career.
Yeah, so we'll see. It's at least nice that he did some press and that there might be something going on, but even with, as you said, his pedigree, he can't, like, he hasn't had things made. Like, we have no idea.
I just think whenever he has an idea for a movie and like what he wants it to be, it must sound intimidating and too ambitious for studios to, like, especially after seeing Southland Tales fail like it did. Like, when he has a weird idea, they're going to be like, yeah, but like, is anyone going to pay to watch this? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I will.
I will. I'll be there opening night. So there's a comment on this post from Jim Brunzel, who we know.
Do we?
Jim is a festival director.
Yeah.
And have worked with Aglyph in Austin and the Minneapolis Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, we brought him to Minneapolis in 2016, screened Donnie Darko there. In Southland. That's what you went to?
Yeah, I was at that.
Oh, that's the thing that you went to? Yeah, Jim was there.
I tried to go to the Donnie Darko one, but was happy to go to the Southland Tales one.
That's funny, because I think you had just met Jim like the year before at Sundance.
Yeah.
We all ate in that hotel ballroom or something.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he did talk about his numerous screenplays he wanted to direct. He did mention he did some polish and rewriting work for some Hollywood scripts, so he could be working behind the scenes. But now that there is a writer's strike, who knows? I stand by Southland Tales as one of the boldest, strangest films in the 21st century, with a wild cast, and I still watch it every 4th of July and still find different Easter eggs each time. I hope he still directs. He's around 46, 47 and is a talented guy.
Yeah, yeah. That would be cool if he came back.
Yeah. All right. Where you got for rankings?
Looking at this here, I'm just realizing that I need to add a few movies to this. I'm above... God, damn it. I always forget we need to explain the rankings. the rankings are... We're basically ranking every movie we watch since we started these lists. So I started mine at the beginning of 2022. Chris started in July of 2022.
Yeah.
So which is why I have a lot more movies. I'm up to 450 something. I don't know how many movies are actually on it. It wouldn't affect where Donnie Darko is because it's up very high. But on my list, Donnie Darko, of all those movies, is ranked number 27.
Okay. And what's the sandwich?
The sandwich here? So 27, that's super high. Like, that's up there with my faves. So we got
top 1%.
We're starting with There Will Be Blood.
Okay.
Scream.
Okay.
Love Scream. Donnie Darko, Drive, which we've talked about in this podcast. And a little known movie called Tammy and the T-Rex. Paul Walker and Denise Richards' first movie, a very, very strange kind of sort of B movie about Paul Walker turns into an animatronic dinosaur.
It's awesome.
It's,
I mean, that idea is awesome. I've never seen the movie, but I feel like I love it. Okay, nice. That's such a strange range of movies. It's so Travis.
That's every single time I do a sandwich, you're gonna be like, who is this guy?
It's like There Will Be Blood on one end and Tammy and the T-Rex on the other end.
I like them pretty much equally.
Yeah. I have 159 movies, so a lot less. I have Donnie Darko in the tier 2, so it's not in my like tier 1 colossal, but tier 2 amazing. At number 20.
Nice.
So pretty high, but not top 1%.
I mean, that's
like
still
you.
High.
Yeah. The sandwich I have above it, I have X. I think that has to change. I think I like Donnie Dark. Yeah, wait.
I'm constantly shifting my movies.
Yeah, I'm moving that down to...
I did it as we were sitting here.
Yeah. So, okay, I have... This might be recency bias, but I have Bottoms. And then Barbarian.
Okay.
Which, like, Bottoms just... you know, good comedies are hard to find.
Sure, it's a great movie.
Barbarian is just like my kind of movie. Yeah. And then Donnie Darko. Yeah. And then I have X because there's just something to X and the thematic exploration of like aging and rediscovery of youth. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
it's cool. And then RRR.
Oh, man. That would be a great, like, five movie lineup for a movie night.
Right.
You're hitting all the flavors there.
Imagine watching five movies and the last one is RRR, where you're just like, all right, we have watched 8 hours of movies and now we have a 3 hour finale.
But you need something with a lot of energy to keep you up. So,
yeah, that would accomplish it.
Okay. That's Donnie Darko.
Donnie goddamn Darko.
I feel like it must have been one of Patrick Swayze's last movies.
That's a good question.
Let's see. Nah, he made a few more after that. There's just a bunch of movies though that like I've never even heard of.
He does such a good job.
I mean, he's the best. He plays that character so well. Just like bullshitting self-help guru, like it's perfect.
Yeah, when he's on stage talking to the kids, it's just like, oh, man.
That scene's great. That scene's also great because, again, I assume this is what Stephen Poster, the DP, brought in. Like, just really, there's just a sense of, like, expertise to the way the movie shot that while I love Richard Kelly to death, like, I don't think he would have quite had the know-how to pull some of these scenes off. Like, that scene is suddenly shot with a shaky cam, you know? And it has like a completely different feel. Like it feels very like kind of like urgent and ridiculous. Like you're actually there, and it gives the scene like the sense it needs. It's just so cool that like all those little decisions are made throughout that I've just noticed from watching it so many times.
Yeah, it makes it feel far more like a school assembly.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
And next time we know what we're doing, right?
Yeah, Blade Runner.
This is like, as far as I know, like the, well, besides Fight Club, like the Chris movie.
Yeah, it's in my top five, like my actual top five, not my, I mean, it's in my top five on the list, but like of the movies I've actually seen in my life.
Yeah.
And ranking, it's in my top five.
Oh, man. Okay. I'm excited to talk about it. It's a movie. Yeah. I just rewatched it and it's only the second time I've seen it. And it's just, before I had just watched it, it was not a movie I remembered really that well.
Oh, I'm excited to hear about this then.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk about it. Like, I'll leave it at that. Like, I really want to hear what you love so much about it.
Okay.
I'm not saying that as I really enjoyed it, but like, I'm interested to dive into that realm of Chris.
Okay. Beautiful. Perfect.
But okay. Everybody knows what time it is.
Yeah, what do we say to the people?
All right, everybody, listen up, because it's time for Lights,
Camera,
See ya. I think we did it. I think that was good.
I don't think we did at all.
I think we did it.
I think it's on purpose at this point.